There are two particular things that happened while I was at Earlham that changed my life. One is a history of science course in which we were assigned the recently published Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And that book is all about how, you know, we see the world in certain ways, and we scientists construct theories, and then those theories start, of course, influencing what they see, what they measure, and then, you know, the whole Copernican revolution and the whole idea, the idea that our hypotheses actually influence what we can see, and that it takes sometimes hundreds of years for questioners to realize that their whole frame was wrong. And I got so influenced by that, the power of our ideas to shape what we can see. And that has stayed with me through all these decades.
Heritage Radio Network proudly presents Evolutionaries, Francis Moore LePay. Francis Moore LePay is an iconic activist thinker on society and democracy, which she explores through the universal lens of food. Her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971, has since sold over 3 million copies and helped shift the narrative of hunger. In 2008, Diet for a Small Planet was heralded as one of the 75 books by women whose words have changed the world by the Women's National Book Association. That same year, the James Beard Foundation honored Frances as Humanitarian of the Year, and Gourmet Magazine listed her among 25 people whose work has changed the way America eats. Frances is author and co-author to 17 other books, and her work has been translated into more than 15 languages. She's co-founded three organizations: Food First, the Center for Living Democracy, and the Small Planet Fund. The latter was launched with her daughter, Anna LePay, who also co-wrote the book Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. Frances's childhood experiences influenced her lifelong work as an activist.
They started a Unitarian church in the most conservative religious area in the country during the McCarthy era, right? And we were attacked as being communists because anyone who was a Unitarian, the Baptists believed, didn't really believe in God. They had to be an atheist. If you were an atheist, then you were automatically a communist. So our church was targeted by the FBI. My parents were interviewed. Other people lost their jobs. Oh, Texas was misogynistic, anti-intellectual, incredibly racist. It was alien to everything that my parents believed. My dad was stationed there. He was a weatherman for the U.S. government. That was his job, to be in Fort Worth. But none of us fit in. I mean, it was a good experience in the sense of what doesn't kill you, you know, kind of experience, because I learned, you know, to get along with these girls who cried, literally cried over my soul because they were certain I was going to hell. And so, you know, it was, but I could still be friends with them. As a child, my parents took my brother and me to a small island in the Pacific Ocean when I was 9 to 11, which are these formative ages, 2 years. And there were probably 16 or more nationalities represented out of 600 people. It is a tiny island, 1/2 mile wide in the Pacific Ocean, Wake Island. And that, I'm sure, had a profound influence on my being a citizen of the world, in a sense, because my best girlfriend was a mix of Hawaiian, Korean, Japanese, and my little sweetheart at 10 was, that a crush on, was Samoan, you know. So I the world was huge after that experience. I ended up at Earlham College because it was the opposite, I hoped, of where I'd chosen to go to school my first year, which was American University in Washington, D.C. I grew up in Texas, and I wanted to get far away from Texas. And I decided that if I could join the U.S. State Department as an ambassador or some high role, I could, you know, improve the world, help bring democracy to the world. So I went to American University School of International Service, and I was profoundly disappointed and realized in a few weeks that this was not the way to save the world. And also, it was a real party school, whereas my program, we really had to study hard, so the only place I could study was in the stairwells, was the only place I could find quiet. So I chose to leave American University to the opposite environment, a small Quaker school. And I had a friend in high school who had gone there, a friend from another city, and she loved it. So I said, okay, I'm coming. And it was the opposite of American University. And it really helped shape my life path in profound ways.
After college, Frances worked as a covert community organizer in Philadelphia, where she met her future husband, Mark LePay.
I met Mark LePay after I left Durham to go to an organizing school, not to a graduate school, because this was a height, as I say, on the war on poverty and the spirit of we were part of a movement that was going to change America. And various of the leaders of the time, SDS, Students for Democratic Society, were encouraging people to go to the ghettos, as we called them, and be an organizer. And so I wrote a blog on Huffington Post about this. It's called, I Was a Covert Agent in the War on Poverty. And that is accurate. I was hired by the city of Philadelphia covertly, in that I was hired as a housing inspector, but my direct work assignment was to be a community organizer for the welfare rights organization. And so it was in that period that I was hanging out. I lived in West Philly, and I was hanging out with some people there, and they invited me over to the student union. And we were gathered around a table, and suddenly this young man walks in with a ragged bombardier jacket on, and everybody like turns around, and he's the center of attention. And everybody wants to know what he thinks. And this was Mark LePay. And he was getting his PhD at that time in pathology. And he was teaching a course called Biology for Poets. And this was part of what in the 1960s was called Free University, the idea that anybody could teach anything that they cared about. And that was Mark's passion, was sort of the philosophy of science. And so he said, do you want to come hear my lecture? And I said, sure. You know, he was the big guy walking in the door. And I didn't have any paper to take notes. And I remember that night I borrowed a matchbook from somebody and I took notes on the inside of the matchbook. And I sat on the front row, and I don't know if it was that or what, but he asked for my telephone number afterwards. So that was the beginning of my first great love and the father of my children. I organized in West Philly for the Welfare Rights Organization. Then Mark took a position postdoc at UC Berkeley. And I said, oh, well, I guess I should use that opportunity to get a master's degree in social work, because they had a community organizing school at UC Berkeley. So I started there, and I was working in fair housing in Oakland. And at one point that first spring, it was into the second semester, and I projected my life forward, you know, on the proverbial sort of deathbed moment. And I say, wait a minute, how do I know that I'm choosing a path that is really going to root causes? How do I explain why I'm doing this instead of that? And I couldn't answer it. And I was really terrified that I didn't know why I was choosing this path. And I said, okay, I'm making a vow to myself that I will not do anything else again to try to save the world, quote unquote, until I can explain to myself why I'm choosing that particular focus. I was terrified. I was terrified because here Mark had, you know, was already in his postdoc stage. He was a really established scientist doing cancer research. I was kind of lost. And I just was just petrified, but I knew I had to make this choice. So I stayed home a lot and kind of hid away and just started reading and thinking and reading and thinking. And then I started, as a wife of a postdoc, I could audit courses. So I started auditing courses on everything from tropical agriculture to some kind of, I don't know, geology course. I don't know, just trying to figure it out. And this was Berkeley in the 60s, right, late 60s. And the very beginning of the food movement was happening. In the sense that people were asking the questions about the mainstream diet and a lot of people were going, quote unquote, going back to the land. And I met people who were part of that, and I started shifting toward more whole foods. And somewhere along the line, it was also, of course, I shouldn't add to that, it was a time of absolutely frightening literature, whether it be newspaper headlines or books like The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, exploded in 68. And then there was a book, Famine 1975, that came out at the end of the 60s, predicting that there would be widespread famine just in a few years ahead. And I really thought, oh, okay, here's this food, energy around food here locally. Here's this huge question about hunger. Maybe if I could tackle that question, if I could just understand why people are hungry, that would be the thread I could follow through all this complex economic and political reading that I was doing. Just follow the food, if you will, because everybody needs food. It's quantifiable. How much we need is quantifiable. And it was a hunch, and it was a great hunch. So I went to the UC Berkeley Agricultural Library, found a friendly librarian, and I let one question lead to the next question with my dad's slide rule, which I still have, and putting the numbers together. And very soon in that, I realized that, wait a minute, hunger is not the result of scarcity, that we're actively creating this experience of scarcity when there's plenty of food. And so I just wanted to tell people, and thought that if I first just created a one-page handout, tacked it around Berkeley, that people would say, oh my gosh, we can do this, we can end hunger. It didn't quite happen that way, but it did become a book, and the story, you know, is ongoing.
In 1975, Francis co-founded with Joseph Collins the California-based Food First Institute for Food and Development Policy. They've also collaborated on the book World Hunger, 10 Myths, published in 2015.
We were alive at a time when there was a real food movement. There was a real awareness, a world hunger movement. And the frame of it was a charity frame, that those poor people over there don't have enough, and we have so much. And so how can we be more generous? And how can American farmers ship more abroad? And of course, the farmers loved that because it gave them a sense of purpose and a better return if we framed it that way. So Joe and I, from the very beginning, challenged that frame. And Food First, the thesis of it is virtually every country in the world has the capacity to feed itself. The appropriate frame is not charity, it is empowerment. And our theme then was the term food self-reliance, which now the current term for that same concept is food sovereignty, where people are empowered enough in their own communities that they are developing their food resources to be able to feed themselves. Because as we asked then, and we ask in the new book, if a society can't feed itself, how independent can it ever be vis-a-vis outside influences? I mean, you're always going to have to kowtow to some other foreign power if you're dependent on others for food, right? So that was a theme about people being able to feed themselves. So the meme of how do we feed the world always rubbed us the wrong way, and we never like to use that at all, is how are people enabled to feed themselves? And the new way I talk about everything is how do we stop the creation of hunger through the kinds of societal rules that we are creating moment to moment.
Francis set out to travel the world in search of on-the-ground solutions to hunger and to capture these answers in a book. She enlisted her daughter, Anna LaPay, in the process.
I was planning to write a book, traveling the world, to look at where are people actually addressing solutions? Where are solutions emerging? And I wanted to tell those stories. I wanted it to be a very motivating book. And I really needed a partner to do this because, or at least it was a lot more fun with a partner. And I think initially it was my son who was going to do that, and he got caught up in various things. And Anna got really excited about it because she could get college credit for it. It was right at the end of her master's degree. And so we traveled the world for 9 months together, and it was a blast. And guess what? She got to meet two people that eventually won Nobel Peace Prizes for their work. One was Wangari Maathai, who has absolutely changed my life. I call her my lodestar of courage. So here Anna was at 26. She was the age that I was when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, meeting the most courageous and brilliant leaders, whether on land reform in Brazil or on tree planting in Kenya or, you know, the seed protecting the indigenous seed in India or microfinancing in Bangladesh. I mean, this was just such a huge eye-opener for both of us, but for her, as a young woman, to see her first dive in, I think that's what changed her life, even if I'd been anybody, you know, but to have that opportunity to meet those people was, I think, what really motivated her. And now she's good friends with Mungari Mathai's daughter, who's taken over the Greenbelt movement in Kenya. So I think that experience changed us both profoundly. I mean, for me, it convinced me that what I'd been talking about all these decades was not a pipe dream, that it was really happening. And for her, it just totally caught her passions, and she's taking it in these beautiful directions that are distinct to her. I think we have so much to give because we came to adulthood at a time when there was a sense of a movement that we were part of. We know what that feels like in a way that you all can't. And that's why I'm so fired up about I'm 71 now, right? So I'm so fired up about my, you know, 60s through whatever. You know, Howard Zinn is my new model, right? I want to die swimming when I'm in my 90s like he did. Think about what Howard Zinn did in his 20 years. There's tremendous, tremendous excitement in my generation about the intergenerational collaboration that didn't exist when I was a young person and kind of writing off older people. But now, you know, so many people who came to adulthood in the 60s are so fired up about climate change and the food crisis and so many other issues. So I feel it's a really right moment for us to be able to infect the younger generation with what it felt like to be a movement. And I want to call it, you know, a democracy movement that touches every issue. So that's really what I think that I want to say to other people my age is, forget that concept of retirement. You've just begun. You've just begun to live. And in a way, I feel that's by far the best period of my life, absolutely the best period of my life. I often say that I don't like the expression follow your passion because that could be very intimidating. What if I don't have a passion? So what I did was I followed my curiosity. I asked a big question and that led me to the next question and to the next question. And maybe the highest compliment I've ever gotten from a friend who said, Frankie, I love it that you asked the question behind the question. And that's what I mean by, you know, asking the next question. So, and trust that. Trust that if you really have a question that you have to answer and you set out to answer it, that that will lead you to the next question. You do not have to figure out the rest of your life, because I think that's what's paralyzing for young people, where they have to figure out, you know, exactly where they want to be years and years hence. That I think of life as this mosaic where they're, it's not like continuous colors throughout like a rainbow, but there are periods in your life where these bright reds and then the yellows and then the blues and you might come back to the reds again, you know, that, but it's trusting that your curiosity is telling you something important to listen to. And now it's so much easier to do that. You don't have to have access to the UC Berkeley library. You do it in effect. I end all of my writing and thinking and speaking on themes about what is power and rethinking power as not a thing that's over there, that kind of a threatening thing that somebody else has, but power simply its Latin root meaning, which is our capacity to act. And really emphasizing that power is not just guns and money. Power is our astute wisdom, the analysis. Power is our courage to step out and do things like ask this woman all these questions you're asking her today. Power is, you know, our ability to bring people together and to have a sharp focus and to go deep, deep, deep in understanding the roots of these hunger crises as the scarcity of democracy. So I guess the theme of my life is this rethinking power as what we create together, and that is ever expanding in a positive direction, and that if we think of the world from an ecological perspective where we're all embedded in these interacting systems, then the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world. Because everything we do or don't do is changing the world. And just drop that idea of powerlessness, because it's a fiction. Because in a connected world, you know, if we're all connected, we're all implicated. If we're all implicated, then we're all sharing responsibility, and every step we take matters tremendously.
Frances's most recent book is World Hunger, 10 Myths, published in 2015. This piece was produced by Jack Inslee. This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for Heritage Radio Network, with additional production by Holly Cederholm.